This program was first broadcast on Arrow FM, Wairarapa's only community access media station, and shared on Access Media with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Steve, welcome, welcome, welcome to the May edition of Book Lovers Wairarapa.
Hello, Gareth.
I'm Gareth Raps, and I'm co-host Steve Lawrence, and this is your one-hour program about the wonderful world of books on 92.7 Arrow FM, Channel 41 on Wairarapa Free TV. Steve, it's been a big month. We're in the autumn. What is happening in Wai Word in May?
Okay.
I know, we had Linda first.
We did. So May, back at the beginning of the month, we had Linda Taylor come down from Hawke's Bay to talk about her book, The Cinderella Service.
Right.
Now, this is a young adult novel, and we got her to have a kind of a co-presenter with Diane Bardsley. And Diane has published, about 16 books. They're all about words because she was the head of the New Zealand Dictionary Project.
Outstanding.
But she also wrote probably the seminal work on the Women's Land Service a few years ago, and they had a very interesting chat about what happened to these young ladies from about 1940 when the men were sent off to the war. And
a lot of them would be gone by now. You had put all that 80 years on top of their 20.
There are, I think, probably none left. Oh, no, there is one.
There you go.
Because there, one of our Wai Word ladies, Philippa Tucker, is the assistant editor of a magazine called Shepherdess Magazine. And a couple of editions ago, the woman on the front was a woman well into her 90s, who looks about 70, who was and had been a part of the Women's Land Service. So,
But hey, the book, the talk?
Yeah, it was good, really good. And Linda's husband, if you're listening to this, he'll be cross because I can't remember his name. Anyway, he's worked in museums most of his life making models.
Really?
So he'd made a quite interesting group of displays, which he got in the back of his lens of his station wagon.
Weta employs such people,
yes.
Modelers all the time. Good audience?
Yeah, good, really.
Yeah, no, it's
interesting.
Big topic. But now moving on, Mark Pacey.
Yeah, Mark, a lot of people, a lot of our listeners will realise, works for the Wairarapa Archive. He's written, he's regularly appears in the Times Age, and he's written a book called Our New Zealand Home, which was about a Marine Division, which spent part of the war in barracks here in Masterton.
There's been a little bit about this in the midweek, and the Times Age
absolutely.
Have been talking about this, and photos to go with it. So.
Yeah. So,
that's topical. So
he's going to talk about producing the book, researching it, something that's historical, and
good one. The audiences for these, you fit everybody in?
Oh yeah, we have them at. So this will be in the Carterton Community Courthouse in Holloway Street.
Nice venue.
Yeah,
but I can imagine that could get
on the 8th
filled
of June.
Up pretty fast.
Well.
You just squeeze them all in?
Yeah, well, we had Lloyd Jones. We had about 80 people in there.
And that was comfortable? And
no.
Yeah, there we go.
It's better with less than 50.
Right.
So it is a great venue, actually.
Yeah, that is wonderful. Now, I see you survived Booktown Featherston. Any impressions and afterthoughts?
Well, it's taken me a couple of weeks to get over it. It's extremely hard work for the booksellers. It was a bit. We've set up in a marquee. It's not a tent. It's a marquee.
Proper. But I've seen you in the Anzac Hall.
Yes. Well, we used to be in the Anzac Hall, and they used to run their events in the Kiwi Hall, which sits about 60 or 70, which is off the Anzac Hall. But Booktown's grown to the point where that's not a big enough space for the audiences that they need, and they need the whole of the Anzac Hall, which means they had to find somewhere else to put the booksellers.
You got bumped.
We did, to outside.
And the weather was?
Well, the weather on the Saturday and Sunday was spectacular. The weather on the Friday was equally spectacular in a completely different way. So on the Friday afternoon when we're taking in all the books, it was raining.
It was...
And it was... Because it had been raining for a while and they didn't put the tent up until about midday, the ground underneath was wet and the gutters were running, and then they turned the heaters on and it gets a bit steamy, and books don't always like that.
No, we want our pristine book from the bookseller.
Yeah, we eventually flattened them all out. But it's...
But hey, a big 3 days, and, you know...
Yeah.
And the booksellers were happy? They
Yeah. Well, David Headley is their official bookseller.
Yeah.
And he, is in exchange for that, he carries books for all of the presenters, of whom there were somewhere over 80. So he and Anna, who came up, Headley, who came up from Dunedin, I think, to help, they, yeah, it's a huge undertaking for them.
And then the little signings afterwards, yeah, and moving the books.
Yeah. So we tend to focus more on kids' books.
Yep.
Because of the voucher thing.
Yep.
So what we get is a mad rush on Friday to set up, hang out till, I don't know, about 6 or something, go home. Quite a long way from Greytown, from Featherston to our place. Anyway, get back for about 8 o'clock the next morning to be organised, because the first event's at 9 and people start, what, the people queue through the bookseller's tent, which is great.
Good idea.
But it means we have to be fairly early, and we're there, last event finishes just after 5. So,
and then there's a bit of socialising with the booksellers. I mean, this is like kindred spirits.
Well, so there's not much socialising.
Everybody's
shattered.
Knackered. Yeah.
So then Sunday, it's the same. And then we go back on Monday, and they bus in all the school kids for a couple of hours, and that's...
That sounds frightening.
Yeah. I don't know how much they pay primary school teachers, but it is not enough.
Anyway, those wonderful new readers that are out there on the horizons, and I'm...
Well, that's absolutely right, and we do our best to cater for them by providing them with stuff that they might like, which they are in a position to buy because they're generously all given two $10 vouchers.
Yeah. My feedback I heard from our book club, and a lot of them went to events, and they said it was terrific, and even a couple of them scored free books, free poetry books, you know, like... People just were handing out books that are, you know, from print runs from back in the day, and they were just moving them on. Everyone, they were very excited. So,
yeah, very well attended, a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I didn't get out of the tent, so I can't really comment, but I understand Featherston itself was very busy.
Steve, the idea is that you should be flaneuring around and let the team, the staff, do the stuff, so and you go and network.
You've met our team, that's Deborah.
Well,
because we've got the shop open as well, of course, because it's Mother's Day.
Oh, and they've got their things to go and visit all the shops and get. Don't they get things signed off? Is that weekend or is that too?
No, that's different. That's the bookshop hop, which is back in October or September or something. Anyway.
Cutting away from that, Occam's. It's May is Occam time. We saw it on TV. The waiting is Damien Wilkins going to arrive? His publisher was up there accepting it on his behalf, and he suddenly runs in off stage right, and having galloped from the train from the plane, which was delayed, and sensationally takes away his check for 60 large.
60, 65 or something. Yeah, it's a lot of money.
A lot of money for his book, Delirious.
Hmm.
How's that, the winner, how does that impact on the bookshop? People come in the next day asking about it?
No.
I mean, it's a good book. We've reviewed it on the show, and I wish it all the best. And, you know, it's just such a cool Wellington book. Got a big stack of books to get through today, team, so we need to move on. And
we're going to move on actually with the biggest book of all the big books. And very, very quickly, I've been reading Mythos, which is part one of Heroes, Troy, Odyssey. Mm. And I've, you know, silly, I started with Odyssey, the last part of it, Odysseus making his way home, and wondering what was really going on, who were a lot of these characters, which Mythos has it. Now, this is, I've only seen this really in paperback until I saw it in your shop and then found a library copy. It is a stunningly good book.
Hmm.
You know, the illustrations, the artwork.
Illustrated book, yeah.
This text size, if you're ever reading it out, you know, a teacher in a classical studies class or something like that, fantastic. But how come you've got this book? I mean, it's a real, it's, isn't it expensive?
It is expensive.
Beyond like, belief?
Slight, well, slight error of judgment on my part in that Random House, Penguin Random were having a bit of a special of some stock that they had in Auckland, because they have a warehouse in Auckland of some titles, not by no means everything, but a lot of the stuff they think they're going to move in volume. And they
it's not like a supermarket. You go along with your shopping cabinet.
No, they just send us a list.
Oh, so, okay, yeah.
And there was a lot of stuff that we would normally stock anyway, at a bit better discount. So I got quite a lot of stuff, and I put a tick by Mythos because we've sold it consistently, not realising that instead of the $30 B-format the, paperback, I'd
the deluxe.
Picked the deluxe, super heavy, illustrated, lovely, expensive.
Yeah, beautiful coffee table book.
Yeah.
And for somebody, I just totally appreciating this book.
Mm.
You know, I don't want it to end. I'm, a quarter of the way in, and it is fantastic.
Mm.
The etymology, how words come from all the Greek gods and the creation of the gods, the origin story, it's terrific.
Mm.
Totally give it. Big ticks. But let's move on to that imposing stack over there.
Well, what I want to talk about first is a book that's not that imposing, but I just think it's interesting. I've only had it a couple of days and haven't got many copies, but this is a book written by Sean Brown, who's a reasonably well-known New Zealand journalist. It's called The Hoar Alchemists, which sounds really odd.
This is Hoare, H-O-R-E.
Yeah.
And as in all black.
Yeah, so yes. They're not alchemists at all. They were, it's called Turning Cornish Tin to Maniototo Gold. So this is
That's
a very large family of Cornish tin miners who came out to the goldfields in the 1860s. So it's just a
kind of whole lot on one boat or on a series of boats?
I don't know. They're 15 brothers or something. Anyway, the thing that's interesting, and I was just reflecting on immigration and what it means, because in here there's a photograph of one of the 1937 All Blacks. There's a photograph of Andrew Hoare, who's in 2011.
Way more contemporary, yeah.
Contemporary, all black. There's a picture of John Hoare, who then became John Grinnell, because John Hoare seemed like a funny name to the Americans.
Who, as a kid, I used to see in Central Otago and Naseby singing on small stages, singing great country, you know, the Streets of Laredo, things like that. And he had a stunning voice.
Mm,
and then went to America and changed his name.
Yeah.
For stage reasons.
Yeah.
They didn't think Hoare as a name was going to travel well.
May have had
he was fabulous.
Yes.
Yeah,
he was very good. There's a whole chapter in here, unfortunately, of Hoare descendants who gave their lives in two world wars fighting for this little country. There's a piece here about a guy, a descendant who, for some reason, they had the name Pasco and set up a jeweller shop in Auckland, and just at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, then opened two more jewellery shops, and the family still runs Pasco's Jewellers, a chain of 500 jewellery shops, which
it's
the biggest in Australasia.
It's one of the great franchise jewellery, yeah. I mean, with Michael Hill, but it is, you see their shops.
Everywhere.
You see them in Australia.
Mm.
But the bigger picture, the idea of what immigrants offer a young country and the impact of like this one family on New Zealand life. They were basically South Islanders for a long time and then sort of seeped into the whole country.
Well, there's so many of them that they'd be all over the place, but fundamentally they're still, Central Otago.
No, and one of the, it's kind of Who doesn't love an immigrant success story of people who come, become new Kiwis back in the day and, in fact, impact us positively, you know? And it's kind of like it's the better lens of immigration, that all this potential is, you know, arriving, you know, and it's kind of like, are we a good enough country to provide opportunities for them to flourish and actually, you know, contribute to our, you know, our New Zealand? So
well, I'd really like to hope we are, because this is still a young country.
Sure.
And there's still plenty of scope for people from all over. I'm led to believe we're getting a lot of Americans now.
Funny that.
We've had lots of people from the Middle East, and you know, people get a bit anti-Muslim for no reason.
I read a couple of paragraphs, nicely written.
Well,
you know, he can tell a story.
Yeah, he was a good journalist.
Worked
as a journalist and broadcaster with the ABC in Australia, NZBC, TVNZ, BBC.
Yeah.
Most recently with SBS in Australia until he's retired in 2011.
I see it displayed.
Managing director.
In your New Zealand books as I come in, but the main display area.
Mm.
What's happening there today?
Oh, we moved everything around over the weekend on Sunday.
So to watch the space, because it's kind of like usually very good. And I was going like, where is all the stuff?
Yeah. What we were trying to do is create a little bit more room for the cafe, and also just open up the sight lines in some areas and create a bit more privacy in others. So it involved shifting a whole hell of a lot of books and haven't put them all back yet.
What it means is for you know, bookshop citizens is that you need to visit Elmo's and see the subtle but telling changes. Next big book, Tim Winton's Juice. Now, this is in my hands, actually, and I've recently finished, because it's our book club have selected it for its, like, September read. And
you gave yourself a couple of months to get it done.
Look, it's and you're with our book club promised that we wouldn't have big books, and suddenly, you know, this thing coming in at probably 500 pages, but it's a great 500 pages, and it's for fans of Tim Winton, they're not going to be disappointed. It's the setup is kind of it's a cli-fi book, climate fiction, and two fugitives, a man and a child, sort of arrive at an abandoned mine, and they are, which looks like a promising refuge, but they're not alone, and so begins a sort of a kind of journey, a propulsive journey, actually, through a life trying to be a good man or child in a time of barbarism. So it's kind of echoes of Mad Max, if you like those movies, The Road by Cormac McCarthy, dystopian, big story. And it's really basically this one day and night where he is trying to explain in the situation they've ended up in, how they've come to be here. First-person narrative, love those sort of stories. Harsh Aussie outback features always, as it does in Tim Winton's book. It is very, very good, and it's been well reviewed, and you can find this book at Elmo's.
Yes, you can, but only in a very large hardback. It's not in paperback,
right. Yeah,
which is a bit unusual these days for fiction.
That's good. No spoilers. This book, you really need to know what's going to happen. It's got a fantastic build to where it ends. So big ticks on Tim Winton. Right. Over to you, partner. What have we got next?
Well, I've just brought along a few things that I thought, mostly new stuff, which I thought might be interesting. First book I'd like to mention, which is by no means new, This is the movie tie-in for The Salt Path, Rainer Wynn's autobiographical story of how, in the face of financial and health catastrophes facing her and her husband, where they finished up homeless, penniless and sick, they went on a 630-mile walk on the southwest coast path from Somerset to Dorset via Devon and Cornwall and changed their lives.
I saw the trailer.
Mm.
Spectacular scenery if you, you know, love. And Kiwis are kind of have an affinity with coasts.
Yes.
We like walking along them. Mm. And so we walk along with this unbelievable scenery, and this tale is going to unfold. My suspicion was that the book actually may end up being more powerful than the movie, even though I imagine I haven't seen the movie yet, but the reviewing of the book saying, is this a good tale?
Yeah, and it has sold really well for years, and she's written a sequel or two.
It's kind of like been just rediscovered now. So now it gets a nice new cover?
Gets a new cover with a picture of Gillian Anderson.
And he's European, isn't he, the actor?
Who's that? Jason Isaacs, I don't know who that is.
Yeah, no. Either that or he's I think people won't be unfamiliar with him.
No. Tale of triumph, of hope over despair, of love over everything. That's the movie. But, this, you know, that's the story.
Okay, we'll keep an eye.
So I just thought it was worth bringing people's attention that we do have this.
And it is
attractive.
I think that'll find an audience, actually. It's been an audience for years, so the movie is going to make people more interested.
Well, I think it is probably a movie that will make people feel that they should read the book, because there's always more detail in books.
For sure.
The movies, they turn it into an hour and a half, whereas it leaves out a lot, generally.
Now, I've got a little book in my hand, after the big books, just a little one. And I saw this in your bookshop and read it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a book, it's the sort of book I'd love to find on, you know, some people have got the coffee table and it's got books stacked on it and books under, you know, sort of underneath and all that sort of stuff. And it's one of those places that it's just a neat, fun book to pick up. It's really iconic moments in the world's greatest fashion event. It's a fundraiser, and I understand the tickets are in the six figures to go to attend it.
Hmm.
Now, that in itself makes it incredibly exclusive, but it happens in May every year. That's when I suddenly saw it on TV 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
I think
people
Lord,
wear all sorts of things.
Yeah, Lord. It was actually, the theme was men and what, you know, how diverse men, but men had what their impact was. That was a sort of, they always have a theme. But Lord was on it with a really, some sort of strapless number that, and it's good to see a Kiwi. It's pretty rare that we get onto the carpet.
Mm.
But night started in 1948 for sort of the A-list crowd who pose on the steps of the Museum of Modern of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. The first Monday of May is when it happens. It's the biggest ever fashion event on the calendar and celebrities flock to it to show stuff, and it kind of, it's over 80 years of just great, great photos. And it's a book done in decades, and it's just picked the very best, of things that happened. It's not
really a book to read, is it? It hasn't got any words in it to speak
of. No, it's just a book to, you know, for anyone interested, least bit interested in fashion, would love to find this book on somebody's coffee table, the Met Gala.
And it's a lovely little production, actually. The gilt edges and bits and bobs. That's what you need.
I'm going to put that in there as we now turn to.
Oh, okay.
this is like a tennis match. You know, I'm just hitting the ball back over the net here.
This is a book just taken out of the box today. Joanne Harris's new novel, Vianne, which is a prequel to Chocolat. So it's the same sort of mix of most of her stuff about France and cooking and...
Wasn't that Juliet Binoche and Chocolat? I mean, who didn't love that?
Yeah.
Who didn't love Juliet?
Mm.
Chocolate and Juliet, it's a great, it's a winning combo.
Mm. So, I clearly haven't read it. I don't suppose anybody has because
it's great to get a
brand new release. So,
a little bit of Joanna Harris.
Joanne.
Joanne.
Yeah.
Big?
Mm.
I mean, there are... I said the name seems kind of like, well, maybe I'm just getting mixed up with the male Harris. Right. Because I'm not familiar. I haven't read one. I haven't read Chocolat, actually.
Well, to be fair, you're probably not necessarily in the...
The demographic? Okay. No,
not necessarily. Anyway, just here.
There it is there. Continuing our run of books that one can find at Elmo's, Robert Cray's latest book, The Big Empty.
Mm.
A, big ups for the title, I think that's, which is a kind of like a little outside area of LA, not too far away. It's in the sort of greater metropolis area, but it's a little bit different. And this is his 20th thriller. And I can proudly say I have read every one of them.
Okay.
I am a Robert Cray fan. And he's a private eye, Elvis Cole, and when he's sort of leading the book, he's very in the first person, but he is very, very funny. He is, you know, he operates in his Hawaiian shirts and shorts, but he is just wisecracking his way through the case. He has a partner, the sort of laconic Joe Pike, who is a kind of state assassin who does sort of wet work for the American government, but is his buddy and gets involved. When the cases get out of hand, Joe glides in to...
sort things out, tidy up a bit.
It's just the offbeat humour that is kind of cool all the way through it, of Elvis Cole. Very LA, very, very contemporary, very kind of like... Michael Connelly and Robert Cray really have got this LA, you know, scened down. Relentless PI work, you know, classic cold case investigation, lots of threads. New readers can't go wrong. I'd suggest if you'd like to start with Sunset Express, Voodoo River, or LA Requiem. Now, I'm pretty sure you've got other Robert Cray's in your collection.
We do. I don't know where those ones, but...
There are a lot of them.
Yeah.
You can't go wrong, but it's just kind of like, I do think he's got onto something with Elvis Cole that's kind of really addictive. And launch into them. There's lots of them to read, and there are no bad ones. They really work. So there's our little PI private. We like to have a little bit of that genre...
Oh,
all the time, just so people know that this, it never ends.
Well, it never does end. I'm desperately trying to remember the name of the writer, but a lady came in this morning looking for a book by someone who I'd never heard of, and I looked her up, and it's a series of novels with a Turkish detective, and there's been 26 of them. I never heard of them.
Well, and it's, we've all got our favourites if we tuck this in the books that we kind of can't wait for them to get the next one in. Moving on the stack.
Very similar. Linda LaPlante. New one, Crucified. It's the new Jack Waugh thriller. Detective Jack Waugh should be resting on his laurels. He's just put sadistic serial killer Rodney Middleton behind bars, ready to enjoy some time at home with his young family. But! So, there we go.
Her books sell steadily. American? Yeah. French?
No, she's English.
Zealand? Kiwi?
No, she's English.
English?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I've tended to dip into all these writers back in the day just to test them, but it never got me into
going on to the next one?
Well, she's Jane Tennyson, so that was Helen Mirren on the telly.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
So those are the...
And Mirren tends to make everything a winner.
Yeah, so that was the basis of what she was doing, and then she's writing about Jack War. We've got her biography as well, her autobiography, obviously. You'd write your own if you were a writer, wouldn't you?
You would. Yeah. Now, moving on to... got something a little bit new now for Book Lovers Why Rapper.
Mm.
What we've got is... and Steve, it's driven out the fact that you are a bit of a quiz whiz. And, you know, I have been on your teams, and we do well, and you know stuff.
Mm.
And so what there was an article in a February listener saying who are the 10 best, who have sold the most books in the last decade,
mm-hmm.
and had a little article on it. So I thought I'm sat down and took questions from that. So I'm going to put you under a bit of time pressure for about 2 minutes,
right,
firing questions at you and seeing, in, you know, Bradley Walsh style or maybe 7 days, you know, style, where you have to sort of come up with the best you can under time pressure.
Well, I probably won't know anything.
Well, timing is starting now. Who is the top-selling writer in New Zealand? Born in Tiamutau?
Tiawamutu?
Tiamutau? Tiamutu, yeah. Is one of her books has sold 18 million copies worldwide.
18 million
she
copies.
She met a character in Australia, and his story became...
18 million copies.
Yeah, I know. That was stunning. Because actually, of our top 10, that was actually about 320,000 books. Considering, you know, I was selling 5,000 copies in New Zealand.
That's a pretty good effort.
It's a great effort. So these people have collectively sold 320,000. But this book has been a worldwide hit. Do we know it? No, we don't.
Was that Little Catton as the biggest?
No. She's not. This is number one. Her name is Heather Morris. And it was the Tattooist.
Tattooist of Auschwitz.
Yes. So we're giving you nothing for Heather, but you do know the Tattooist.
Yeah.
Eleanor Catnell wrote 2 books. Can you know big books that we know about?
She's written 3.
She's written, yeah, there's the very first one.
And the first one was The Rehearsal.
Yes, The Rehearsal was first. And name any others?
Well, The Luminaries. And then
Burnham Wood. Very good. For a bonus point, what year did she win the Booker? For The Luminaries. Have a guess?
2014.
Correct. Well done. Excellent. Getting 2 ticks there. Nancy Bella Pellegrino?
Yeah. Not Nancy.
Nikki
Pellegrino. Look,
Nikki,
yeah.
That was a test too. Look, and you pass that one, you get a point for saying Nikki, not Nancy. Nikki, the book that made her famous.
Oh, something about Greek weddings or something.
It's very similar to Damien's winning book, Delicious.
Oh.
Didn't know that? No. Okay. Who is our great romance Mills and Boons writer? Sold 7 million copies worldwide, has 30 novels.
No idea.
Nalino Singh.
Nalino Singh? Oh, really? I didn't think those were romance.
Well, she writes a bit of paranormal. Did I put
sort of,
you wrong
they're
there?
Sort of romanticy.
Well, romanticy is actually called romantics.
But they're all a bit bloody vampires, aren't they?
Well, Mills and Boons. All right, moving on. Here we go. How many men make the top 10 list? Was it 1, 2, or 3?
Maybe 1.
1 is correct. Who is that person?
Don't know.
Witty Ihamira.
Oh, okay.
What was his breakthrough book?
Whale Rider?
Correct. Which, of course, that was made into a great movie by Taika.
Yes.
Catherine Chitty just got a new, latest big book that was launched at the Readers and Writers. Can you remember the title?
It's The Book of Guilt or something?
Correct.
Because that interesting story, although she wasn't at Featherston, I unpacked our stock of her new book. on the Friday, so I took them down and sold them all. So, and we spent a couple of weeks without me.
That is the hottest ticket. What do you think of the cover, the woman running with the two little children on it?
It looks like an Edith Blyton cover.
Perfect. I thought so too. For some bonus marks, what can you name other books by Catherine Chitty?
X-Men's Carnival.
Correct.
Pet. What was the one before that? There was one about...
There was the German one.
This one, there's something about chiming bells or something.
Remote Sympathy or Symphonies was what I was looking for. Moving on to the end. Now, here's the question. Her debut of a novel was in 2019. It was published by Scribe. It won the Niall Marsh Award for Best Crime Novel. The title has three letters.
So is it OA?
Correct. And for a bonus point, written by?
Becky Manawa too.
Correct.
I never thought that was a crime novel, really.
Yeah, it was a bit crime-ish. Anyway, you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 10 out of 12.
I still think our biggest selling writer's got to be Lindley Dodd, doesn't she?
No, didn't make the cut.
Well, they probably don't think she's...
For some reason.
Because everything rhymes about Bottomley Potts and...
They didn't look. I should have probably said like adult sort of stuff. Should. So I put you wrong here. But hey, well done on the kids. It just shows you that you have a deep and impressive knowledge of the book scene, which I expect, of course.
You should do. Right.
Yes. Right. Moving on. Now we have over there.
Oh, it's just a couple of other new things. Rachel Joyce, who is the author of probably our biggest ever selling fiction title, which is The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry, has a new book called The Homemade God.
Harold Fry was huge.
Very big, yeah.
Then it became a huge movie. Was it Jim Broadbent?
Yes. It was our go-to book for a long time because every bookseller needs something reasonably current. That when people come and say, I just want something to read, that you can recommend with confidence, knowing, because it's a big responsibility. It's not the $30 or whatever. It's the several hours that people have to
invest,
set aside for this thing. And if it's rubbish, they'll never forgive you. So,
but that's knowing your audience and knowing what...
Well, it's knowing that lots and lots of people have come back in and said, I really like that book, made me cry.
I think
so we've
an emotional response. That's what you want from a book.
Consistently sold, Rachel Joyce. This is a kind of a family saga about a world famous artist who, after years and years and years of being a widower, remarries and shortly after that drowns.
Oh, that's not a spoiler, is it?
No,
that's just on the back cover as the story is going to go from. Now a little bit of non-fiction. Chris Hayes' book, The Siren's Call.
Mm-hmm.
Now this is, you pick this up, on reviewing, I must have spotted it in the listener or something, and it says how attention became the world's most endangered resource. And it goes, this is a book about the assault that attention has. We all feel it, the distraction, the loss of focus, the addictive focus on the wrong things for far too long. We bump into zombies on their phones in the street, and sometimes they're us. We stare at pity at four people at a table in a restaurant, all on their phones, and then we feel the buzz in our pocket. Something has changed utterly. For most of human history, the boundary between public and private life has been clear, at least in theory. Now, in this book from Chris Hayes, with the help of a few tech firms, we have basically tore it down in a decade. Hayes argues that we're in the midst of an epoch-defining transition. Attention has been a commodified resource extracted from us and from which we are increasingly alienated. because there's a breaking point, sirens are designed to compel us. So the idea is, you know, when the siren goes down in Greytown or in Carterton for fire brigades and I imagine
car accidents,
and that sort of thing, this book is trying to be a siren. You know, it's like loud and sort of... And so sirens are designed to compel us, and now they're going off in our bedrooms and kitchens at all hours of the day and night, doing the biddings of vast empires, the most valuable companies in history, built on harvesting human attention. It's a big book. We need to wrest control of our lives, our politics, and our future. So I guess what is really... I mean, this is the issue that's kind of landed on our own political scene is the question of
social media bans for under 16s.
The social media bans, which is percolating hard in Australia, and now it's landed on our desks as our politicians grapple with it. What do you think? What's your take on it?
Well, there's another book, I think it's called The Anxious Generation, by a guy, I think his name is Jonathan Haidt, which is H-A-I-D-T, I think. I've probably got all that wrong. But it's about that sort of thing, but it's specifically about what's happened to the kids. And it's because of this sort of thing. You get...
That's more like a mental health thing, isn't it? On the other side of the impact of it.
Yeah, yes. But it's because you've got kids who physically can't be separated from their devices in case someone wants to get in touch with them about something.
Right.
And the other side of that is the thing that people might want to get in touch with them about might be someone saying something horrible about them, which is going to...
But they'll give it attention because they can't stop themselves.
Stop themselves. And
idea... Like,
The argument about against a social media ban for under 16s is because you can't enforce it. The kids are too clever.
We read about, you know, like China blocking, you know, Facebook, you know, in some ways, or they seem to be websites they can eliminate from the discourse. But how can we, I mean, how could you stop, you know, put on a child's phone saying, look, you're not going to have X and Instagram and BuzzFeed and Facebook and goes on and on and on.
I've thought about that a bit, and I think two things. One is that we're in a situation now where if parents say, look, you've got to get off your phone, you've got to get outside and play, and the kids say, no. But if the parents can say, it's against the law. If you don't get off your phone, the policeman's going to come and lock you up or lock me up. So I think that gives parents more power. The other thing I think is that if there are less and less kids likely to be using their phones at the time that other kids want to send them messages, then the imperative to respond immediately will be less because you're not allowed to do it. So you'll have to wait till it's 11:30 and you can get the torch and hide under your... You don't need a torch because these things are self-illuminating, but hide under your covers and hope, you know. So...
Because the ban on... The school ban...
It seems to have worked.
Has been a, you know, has been a positive... I think the feedback's in that this has worked. It's helping schools cope. And, you know, you arrive, you put your phone into the lockbox or whatever it is, and as you're leaving, you go to your class, your form room, and get your phone, and you're gone. I mean, the kids will say, look, we have two phones, we put one in there, and the real phone is still travels with us. And
I know, but once you've got to go to those sorts of...
I know, it's
more difficult.
I know, but it's... I think, you know, that was a good government initiative, and it's worked, and I think, you know, teachers are thankful for it.
But I think what they're going to do is send this thing to select committee and then people will talk about it and they may come up with something workable out of it.
This book argues, you know, it's not just them, it's like the parents. You know, I live with a wonderful woman who is addicted to the news, absolutely loves watching the 6 o'clock news, and then loves watching on the tab on her iPad news feeds from all over the place. Cannot, does not want to be disconnected to what is going on.
I'll tell you something which I've noticed recently, which is slightly creepy. I'm addicted to news about Ukraine. I mean, I'm obsessed with those poor bloody Ukrainians. And there are 4 or 5 news sites that I look at every day. One's called the Kiev Independent. There's 2 or 3 American ones. And
I don't think you're alone with this at all. I think,
but lately on my PC at work, the stuff I'm getting from those websites is all 2 or 3 years old. Whereas on my PC at home, which I use less frequently to do this stuff because Debbie tells me off, I'm still getting the, 2 hours ago, 10 minutes. So somehow or other, some Russian outfit has got onto the fact that I'm watching, reading these things, and they want to interrupt that flow of information. I'm not saying I feel special, but I feel a bit creeped out by that. So something has interfered with the news feed.
Gosh. Chris's argument is that this is kind of all persuasive. And I have on my tablet comes up how much screen time I've had, through the week. And I go, I don't look at this stuff very much at all. I'm always staggered by what appears on it, And my casual scroll of doom, looking for the things I like, which is, about books and about, the NBA and just my favourite topics are just are always there, always inviting, just come on. My attention is, the algorithm just gets you. It understands you and, and if you show any consumer interest in something, then that is fed endlessly with it.
See, Debbie's fallen into a bit of a trap in that she did have a series, whenever she turned on her phone, there'd be chihuahuas singing popular songs. And now she's moved on to kittens singing popular songs, some of them dressed in cat suits.
This is YouTube madness, and we've all got stories like this. It's interesting that we're discussing our wonderful partners and wives, the things that they have in our own predilections are pushed off to the side.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like.
But getting back to your question.
Do you shut down, and if it's shut down on this phone, is it shut down on that phone? And
I don't know. Anyway, there's too much of it.
Yeah, I know. And it's, well, but, good
but
luck.
But you and I are as guilty as the kids, but,
I know.
At least I'm not worried about someone saying I'm fat and ugly and I'm not going to kill myself on that basis.
But behind these books, there's the big implicit question, which is, how are you going to live your life? What are you going to give attention to? Is it going to be tech? Or actually, are you going to do other stuff away from that? And
there's another bigger question as well. I mean, what's real?
Oh, man, you start watching now. The AI, I can't tell a lot of it apart now. Some of this, that you seem to be able to create in minutes. And it's the visual stuff that's really starting to look stunning.
Well, Debbie was playing with something with AI the other day. It's the first time we've had a go at it. So she said, get it to do something. So I said, oh, okay, write me a pamphlet for the upcoming local body elections. So it went away for 30 seconds and came back and wrote one. So it had gone to every source about everything that had my name on it that might have had something to do with the Carterton District Council and turned out a 2-page thing.
Stunning.
And it was pretty accurate, except it did give me credit for a whole bunch of work on Carrington Park that I had nothing to do with. But
I know. And it's, but hey, look, we're all, AI is just now so pervasive. It's on the edge of everybody's, you're either experimenting or you're trying it out, going like, this is interesting.
I'll tell you what else it did. Because it said, write me a poem about Millie. That's my little dog attacking the shop. So I wrote a little sort of piece of doggerel. And I said, okay, well, write that in the manner of William Shakespeare. So it went away for about 10 seconds and came back with a sonnet.
I love it. I love it. The thing is, but all this is addictive. And all of it is once again, it's our attention being controlled by you know, these big tech companies. They're just harvesting us, and then running down the side is little messages at the same time. So it's books like this, you know, they're cautionary tales saying, hey, wake up a little bit, this is happening. We just need enough readers to read books like, you know, that Chris Hayes is getting us into.
Yeah.
So the sirens call our attention. But anyway, it's good that our listeners and watchers of this program have had their attention directed to us.
That's right. and our cautionary tales.
And our cautionary tales, you know. Stephen King.
Yeah, another new book, just out of the box. People keep saying, coming in saying, you know, have you got what's Stephen King? Was there a new one? Well, there is. It's a detective-y one. Stephen King, Never Flinch. Hold your nerve, face your fears. Don't know much about it, haven't read it. It says on the back, when the Buckeye City, wherever that is, police department...
It's Ohio.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? It's a Buckeye. Yeah, you're right. Receives a disturbing letter from a person threatening to kill 13 innocents and one guilty to atone for the needless death of an innocent man. Detective Izzy Janes turns to her friend Holly Gibney for help. Twin narratives converge in a chilling and spectacular conclusion. Feat of storytelling only Stephen King could pull off. So,
and they continue. You know, there's an audience that they come in, and people will be
And people want they like the backlist too, the Christines and the, you know, all those.
In my travels in America, and I look at visit people and friends and relatives and all that. Often I have seen the whole collection.
Yeah,
and there's a lot of them, you know, and they're like collectibles. It's just like they go. It's just another one on the. You're going to buy another one and put it in the. You know, and he is kind of much loved, and it's kind of like The Shining, sort of. You know, I don't know about horror. It's kind of one of those genres that, like, horror movies make me absolutely. I mean, I kind of react kind of so hard against them, and the books are the same. It's kind of like I'm looking for something else rather than horror.
Well, I think horror is probably more works better in the movies because you get that, you know.
I know.
The man with the axe leaping out of the cupboard. You can't quite do it in the book.
You can't. Well, no. Well, yeah. But the book is the idea for the movies, and it's and there are people who just love to be scared. I think, and you know, get groups of young people watching horror movies, yelling and screaming and hooting as, you know, it don't go in there, you know, that sort of stuff.
Don't go down the cellar. How many times?
I know, and it's kind of addictive. But getting down to the end of our stack, and we've covered a lot today. We're really going well here. I'm looking at like 2, 4, 6, 8, good dozen books that we've glided across. Now the smallest book on our collection, Probable Impossibilities, Musings on the Beginnings and Endings by Alan Lightman. Now, I'm a bit of a fan of Alan Lightman's. He's written novels. He wrote a book, is it Einstein's Dream? Did that ever sort of...
Not sure,
back in the day?
Have a look in the third page and it'll tell you what he's done.
Yeah, he's one of the... What was interesting about him, he's the only person, you know, because he works in Harvard, I mean, they're in the news these days, and MIT, but he's the only person or the first person to have a dual faculty appointments in science and humanities.
Is he the guy who's sort of election guru in the States? Am I getting mixed up with...
Sam Harris does a bit of that.
No, it's someone with a name much like that.
Right. Yeah. No, I haven't seen him politically. Okay. I mean, he's known as kind of like the poetic scientist.
Yeah.
You know, he writes really well. Nice little books. On the big questions, you know, like the origin of the universe, you know, and the nature of our consciousness and things like that. All sorts of writes on nothing. Is it the idea of the concept of it in a beautiful way? Entertaining writer, full of interesting ideas. But it's kind of like, for me, the non-scientists, they're digestible and, you know, I can get it.
That's the infinity symbol on the cover, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. But you pick up Stephen Hawking's
short history of
the time and all that. Quickly, I mean, I felt good for picking it up and virtuous that I was going to read something really heavy and intellectual. I couldn't crack it. It was too big, but this is perfect. The poetry of existence. He muses on the four centuries of scientific breakthroughs. So you get a little bit of history and then where they are with the modern thinkers, where they are landing. Very much challenges the sort of binary view of life. It's not this or that. It's kind of like, hey, it's a lot of stuff. Eloquent. Yeah, I've got a couple of little quotey bits in here, which I kind of liked. I like consciousness, you know. And he goes, in the Matrix, we're well aware of the drama, well into the drama before we realize all this reality experienced by the characters is, in fact, an illusion, a fake movie played out in the brains of human beings by a master computer. And he goes, I would argue that much of what we call reality in our lives is also an illusion, or at least a view of reality largely shaped by our perceptions. First, there is our own consciousness. I will argue later in the chapter on immortality that the magnificent and powerful experience of consciousness is not some transcendental quality rising above the material world, but simply a sensation caused by the millions of electrical and chemical flows within and between our neurons. So who we think we are, Steve and Gareth, it's all kind of illusionary. I mean, that's very Buddhist kind of, that's what's so much down my little, you know, sort of track.
It reminds me of something a physics teacher told me once. I wasn't very good at physics. He said, on a billiard table where one ball appears to hit the other, they never actually contact because, you know, the electrons repel.
There's nothing there, yeah.
And I'm thinking, that's rubbish. One hits the other, one buggers off in a different direction. Clearly they've hit each other.
Newtonian.
Yeah.
Physics, yeah.
Yeah. So he's probably right, but didn't make any difference to me. I know that one ball hit the other.
And he continued on, like, likewise, our human-made institutions. We endow our art and culture and codes of ethics and laws with a grand and everlasting existence. We give these institutions an authority that extends far beyond ourselves. But in fact, I would suggest all these are just constructions in our minds. They are institutions and codes, and their imputed meanings are all mental constructions. They have no reality other than that, what we give them individually and collectively. And it's kind of, I have a confession to make. Despite my belief that I'm only a collection of atoms and that my awareness is passing away neuron by neuron, I'm content with the illusion of consciousness. I'll take it. And I find a pleasure in knowing that 100 years from now, even 1,000 years from now, some of my atoms will remain in the place where I now live in my hammock. These atoms will not know where they came from, but they would have been mine. Some of them once been part of my memory or my mother dancing the bossa nova. Some would have been part of the memory of the vinegary smell of my first apartment. Some will have been part of my hand. If I could label each of my atoms at this moment, I'd imprint them with my social security number and someone could follow them for the next 1,000 years. Some of these atoms will undoubtedly become parts of other people, possibly various people. Some will become parts of other lives, other memories. That's some kind of immortality. It's fascinating, cool ideas that, you know, science with a poetry flavour.
Possibly.
That brings us to the end of the show. We look forward to catching up with you in June, and you can catch this program on Elmo's Facebook page. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gareth.